Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Angelique Rocher about First Freedom, the story of Opal Lee and Juneteenth. I am so happy to welcome Angelique Rocher to The Reading Life to talk about a very special book, First Freedom, the story of Opal Lee and Juneteenth. This is a gorgeous graphic novel that was put together by a whole team of literary folks and artists. Angelique is the main writer. The illustrations were drawn by Alvin Epps, Bex Glendenning, and Millicent Monroe, colored by Damali Beatty, and lettered by Alexis Bennett with End World Design. Angelique, welcome.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here.
What a leader you are to have this wonderful team of people working with you.
I have to shout out, when it comes to graphic novels and comic books, we have incredible editors who are like train conductors and switching stations all in one person. So I wish I could take that much credit, but Megan Brown is an incredible editor who managed people not only across the U.S., but Bex is actually in the U.K.
Right. I love her name, Bex Denning. So this is one of those wonderful projects where you were approached by the publisher and you didn't have to sell them on the power of an idea. The idea was there, which seems wildly appropriate for Juneteenth, right?
It is. And it's wildly appropriate, I think, for Dr. Lee. I smile every time I think about it because she's the exact energy that would we all be so blessed to be 99 turning 100? I hope that I have, right?
I love it that she likes to be called Grandeur by everyone.
Yeah, and she really is that to everyone.
So talk about meeting her. I mean, sometimes things like this happen and there are wonderful results, but you don't have the added pleasure of close contact and knowing you're doing the work they want you to do.
Yeah. So I was very lucky because I've had an opportunity to interview a slew of folks as a journalist. And so the interviewing part is the fun part, right? It's the opportunity to see body language, to hear what words they use, to see when they get excited about certain things, right?
Yeah.
Like even the first story that's in the book is a story that she tells often and is always so excited about when it comes to those buckets. But just getting a chance to spend time with someone who is constantly thinking about how do we make the world better?
Yeah.
How do we make the world more just? And thinking about how do we make people whole so they can be their whole selves and truly be free? It's pretty inspiring.
And such an antidote to despair. You can't let your energy flag when you're around someone like that.
And to think about the fact that she grew up between a farm and a city, a farm that was basically her grandfather getting his 40 acres and a mule. And she grows up during Jim Crow. She survives this devastating mob in 1939, but also the Great Depression and World War II and the Civil Rights era. And she's still this powerhouse of dedication to serving other people.
The servant's heart, as they talk about.
Yeah.
And a teacher.
That's kind of the best thing about it.
I know.
She, you know, she'll always say that she taught third grade so long that she started acting like one of them. And it's that kind of joy, right? I have this motto called unlearn impossible, because at some point in time, and it's scientific as well, the possible is taught out of us.
Right.
We start to think about what is impossible, and we're told we can't, and that's not for us, and girls don't do that, and boys don't do that. And that third grade heart where anything is possible, you kind of think you can still fly, and Santa Claus still exists, and you can be a fireman and a neurosurgeon.
And the doubt hasn't crept in and taken over yet.
Exactly. I think that's such a key to what drives Miss Opal.
Mm-hmm. So give us the broad outlines of Juneteenth and why it grabbed her.
So one of the things I learned about Miss Opal is that she always galvanized towards movements. She was a huge fan of MLK. She was a chairperson of the MLK celebration in Fort Worth. But it was Juneteenth that really clicked with her, and the movement to make Juneteenth a national holiday because of how Juneteenth is used as a symbol of just the first freedom, right? It's that freedom that was given, I will tell people given is not the right word. It was fought for. And in many ways, people had already self-emancipated long before Juneteenth. But that symbolization of freedom and the days. And so I think a lot of people don't know about what Freedom Day used to be like in the South. It would be sometimes the one day that African Americans were allowed to go to the zoo. Or they were all given the day off, or they were able to go to the state fair. It would be Negro Day in many places where they could ride the train for free. And so there is a lot of power and symbolism in the joy and the resilience that comes from Juneteenth. But she took that as a missive to say that is only one part of freedom, right? Juneteenth has now for her become a symbolism of we can't be free unless we're all free. And that means equal housing.
Right.
Access to education, access to health care, access to a living wage across the board. And I couldn't agree with her more.
Mm-hmm. So talk about her walk. This is such an amazing thing.
You know, she started pushing for Juneteenth to be a national holiday in the 90s. With a lot of other incredible leaders, some who are still here, some who are not. And it was right after a Juneteenth celebration, and she called her granddaughter and she said, I want to walk to D.C. And she goes, what? What? We just finished Juneteenth. Like, literally, they were bringing the things in from the Juneteenth celebration. And she goes, well, I'm not going to have to get all the way to D.C. I'm sure, you know, part of the way he sees this 80-something-year-old lady walking to D.C. that President Obama is going to pay attention. Well, she begins walking. And, you know, she went through a couple challenges. Folks thought that it was too political, and so they withdrew their sponsorship. And then they realized, okay, we need to keep Grandeur safe. Grandeur is heading towards
90s. She was like 89 then, wasn't she?
She is. I think it was right before her 89th birthday. And they go, we're going to go where we're invited. And so they began going to different states, and they would do 2.5 miles in the morning. Yeah. And if her body was there for it, she'd do 2.5 miles in the afternoon. And that was in symbolism of the 2.5 years after the enactment of the original Emancipation Proclamation that freed the slaves, but was never, you know, wasn't enforced because the Civil War was still going on. And that turned into a petition, and that petition got hundreds of thousands of signatures. And while it wasn't Barack Obama's honor.
No, it was not.
Because she did start a little bit late in the game. She'll admit, she was like, even her granddaughter was like, we've waited this long and he's about to be out of office. We're going to do it now? Oh, okay.
There were practical considerations. I mean.
Right. But they fought and they brought those signatures to Capitol Hill and they pushed and they kept going until it was finally passed under the Biden administration. It's pretty incredible seeing a woman who spent half of her time during the year on a farm that had no running water, sitting in honor in the White House Rose Garden.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Angelique Roche about First Freedom, the story of Opal Lee and Juneteenth. You must have loved spending time with her.
I did.
I mean, how has her story and her energy transformed your life and your work?
So for me, it was really the researching of her story, right? And so one of the things I had to learn is that compared to Opal Lee, I'm extremely young. And my concept of time is very different. And so when she says young, she means 40. In my brain, I hear young, I'm like 14. So one of the things that I had to make sure we did and do our due diligence is I went back and had to do date-by-date research on a lot of the dates that are in that book. When she got married, when she got divorced, when her children were born, when she moved, where she was registered in certain places, because we'd hit a lot of dead ends, right?
Oh, yeah.
It just so happened that the 3 years she was at Wiley College, they didn't publish a yearbook.
Oh.
Right? And so for me, I've now gone back to school to get my master's degree in library and information science. So that I could become a certified archivist, because it was extremely hard piecing together stories that I know in other communities are readily available.
The world needs more archivists.
I agree. I agree. And it needs more archivists who understand natural language, who understand context is important, not just the artifact, but what the artifact means to the community. And so studying her story and researching her story and knowing that I had to do a lot of due diligence. Like, we would have loved the book to be done in a year, but it took a year plus to make sure the research was correct.
Well, talk about the process of doing a graphic novel, because this storyboarding is like a separate skill. It's a kind of distillation of everything you've done, and everything must serve to move the story along.
Everything has a purpose. And so the beginning, in this case, right, but in most cases, in the beginning, you start off with a pitch, you start off with your one pager, and just like a movie, you start off with a treatment and a script, right? And, you know, if you're doing something really big, you'll have a Bible, just like a regular TV show that'll say who the characters are, where they're from, why they're like this. And for historical graphic novels, you do have to take that extra step of what they call in theater dramaturgy, right? You have to fully understand, well, that wouldn't have existed there. Well, that kind of car wasn't there. Well, she wouldn't have worn her hair like that because that wasn't the style. And that's especially important because Dr. Lee didn't have a picture of herself before she turned 17.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had no reference of Opal Lee before she graduated high school.
Oh, that gives me chills.
So everything that was created before that, it was teamwork between me, the artist, and finding other pictures, like pictures of her children, because she does have one daughter. Like, we really worked on ensuring, but also working with the family. So they did get approval and they saw it over it. But after that, there is a very long script, and it is broken down by panel. Sometimes we stick to the panel, sometimes we don't, and that's when it gets into the teamwork.
Yeah.
And so once it gets approved, once we go through it, the editor says it makes sense, we send it to the artists, and the artists go through and they do those thumbnails and those storyboards, and then we review it and make sure it is actually telling the story that we're trying to tell before they start investing in all of those little details, right?
Yeah.
There's one scene where they're getting off of a train, and in my brain, the original scene had a kid selling newspapers that was talking about Jesse Owens losing his Olympic medal so that I could fully solidify the year was 1936.
Yeah.
That just wouldn't have worked because we had another story to tell of the little kids that were on the platform.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's when the teamwork really begins to happen, and us deciding what is the more important story, what moves the story along, because there's so many pieces of her life we just couldn't fit.
Well, I like that you got in the romance, the teaching. I mean, you got in lots of important, interesting things.
Yeah, I mean,
she's immensely lovable. I mean,
And that's what I wanted people to see. I think sometimes we get so caught up in that incredible thing that a person has done yeah. that we forget to see that they are a sum of their parts. Mm-hmm. We forget that she comes from a grandfather who was a traveling preacher who took care of people and took in strangers to make sure people had places to sleep, who also started a school yeah. in that hometown, right? And that all of her uncles became pastors and almost all of her aunts married pastors. And, you know, we barely inched in that they had moved 15 times before they got to the yeah. house in 1939. But we don't get to talk about the reason why they had to move is because after she found a place to live, when someone figured out she was a single mother with right. three kids, there was no longer room for them. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I really wanted to work in the fact that we kind of all know a grandeur.
We do. Thank goodness. Thank goodness for them. But what was the hardest part for you to write? Because I think you don't skimp on the terrible, direct, personal impact of racism on not just adults, but children. And you're not afraid to put that in this book.
I think the hardest part to write was that Miss Opal never let it faze her. While all of this is going on around her, she is still finding ways to help people. She focused not on marching. Like, look, she made sure people were registered to vote. She made sure that kids had places to play, shoes on their feet, food on the table. And she focused on what she could do. Mm-hmm. But for many people, that is a foreign concept when we tell stories about civil rights. They're waiting for that moment that the person picks up a protest sign yeah. or the person is being chased by dogs or, you know, because that's the image that so many of us are used to seeing. But if you notice in the book, and this is one of the reasons why you see the juxtaposition between her teaching and what's going on in the rest of the world, is that she has, was, and continues to be focused on how do we move forward and address the inequities.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Angelique Roche about First Freedom, the story of Opal Lee and Juneteenth. Now, I'm curious, why did you decide to make it a graphic novel? It could have been any kind of book.
That was her choice.
That was her choice.
Yes. So the...
Oh, that makes me love her even more.
Right? I mean, she is, as I said, she is an educator.
She's up to the minute.
And so she has a children's book. And it just made sense to her because she wants to reach more young people and let them know that they can make a difference, too. That a graphic novel made sense to her. I spent a very long time trying to explain it to her granddaughter, though, who's very much a prose reader. She's like, I don't understand how this works, but I am on board. But that was
I can see grandeur. How you can convince anybody.
I had fun convincing Miss Dion.
Well, talk about the appeal of the form for you personally.
So what I love about it, and I love this as both a sequential storyteller and a professor, is that we are at a point where this new generation does not understand a life without telephones.
Yeah.
They don't really understand a world where there are no cell phones. They'll probably never see a pager. Dial-up is a joke because...
Oh, I remember dial-up.
So do I. Right? And so to think of a world where people are successful and happy and making things happen, where there's no yeah. running water, where you took a horse-drawn carriage to church. Young Opal's biggest complaint, and this was a true story, there was no colored library in Fort Worth when they moved there, which is why we actually shout out Ella Mae Shambly in the book, because she is considered Fort Worth's first Black librarian.
Yep.
And so...
Another kind of hero.
Right? Librarians are my heroes. And so it gives people a chance to take a pause and to see the imagery, right? yes, reading is great, and you know, a lot of us, I love reading prose, but sometimes seeing the image, it allows you to settle in on the reality of what that is. And so I was really excited about being able to bring these images because it also allowed us to take, for lack of a better word, shortcuts.
Yeah.
Because we had the images sitting right in front of you. I did not have to describe what Ruby Bridges looked like. She's right there.
And she's there.
Yeah. So I'm really excited that we took this direction because it also makes each panel a little bit of an artifact.
Well, this may sound like, you know, the most simplistic approach to a book or whatever, but the color palette of this book is exquisite. It just glows in your hands. I mean, the cover is beautiful. The pages.
Damali did an incredible job.
Was that totally up to Damali?
So it was also teamwork. So I would get the colors, and sometimes it would be like, oh, my God. This is amazing. What is happening? And sometimes it would be, okay, so we need to do, because my first question was, and I, again, really appreciate Megan. I was like, so do we have a palette in knowing, like, what brown is being used for what character and, like, how, because it needs to be consistent, but also, like, white folks aren't actually white. So, like, what color are you using so it's consistent, but it's also varied? And so one of the things we did discuss and we did go through, there were a number of times where we're like, yeah, can we put her in yellow? Yeah. So there were, can we make the car green? And in some of my instructions, it did say, hey, she's wearing an XYZ dress because of the symbolism of the color or the moment in time. Or I knew that color that someone would probably use. Yet a character wouldn't have had a red car or that color didn't exist at the time. Back in the 1940s, early 1950s, most cars were black.
Yeah, true.
Right? And so, you know, there were times, but I got to give a lot of credit to the colorist who, you know, I sent them a couple of things about lighting, highlighting and shading as it comes to different brown skin tones because we wanted everyone to be represented. And we also wanted the diversity of Texas to exist. Yeah. And so, yeah, no, but I can take very little credit for the lion's share.
But still, it's so important. And you have to let go of some authorial control to do that.
Yeah, which is, again, Megan, great editor. I miss her every day.
Now, this wasn't your first graphic novel, though, was it?
It was not. My first graphic novel was actually a local nonprofit graphic novel here in New Orleans, Trinity City Number 1, which I think they're about to come out with Trinity City Number 2 pretty soon. But it was actually one of the reasons I came home. I started working on that book, and about my third trip home, I was like, I don't really want to go back to L.A. I want to stay here.
Nice. Good to know. I mean.
Right?
So you're going to combine this love of archives with graphic novels for the future.
I hope so. And work on some, my goal is to work on some historic preservation here in New Orleans with our stories, hoping that this is a proof of concept.
Oh, yes, it is.
That there are incredible stories, especially in New Orleans, that are like literally every step you make, there is an incredible story here.
I can't wait for you to find them all and come back and tell them.
That is
well
the
done.
Goal.
Well done. We've been talking with Angelique Roche, the principal author of First Freedom, the story of Opalie and Juneteenth, created with illustrations by Alvin Epps, Bex Glendinning, and Millicent Monroe, colored by Damali Beatty, and lettered by Alexis Bennett with End World Design. Angelique, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to meet you and have this beautiful, beautiful book.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Josh Weil appears in conversation with Nathaniel Rich and signs What Came West, Friday, June 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poets Emily Cosper, Roger Kamenetz, Kay Murphy, and Anne Pleak read from their work at the June Poetry Buffet, Saturday, June 6th at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. Daniel Fitzpatrick signs Red Robichaux and Other Southern Moralists, Thursday, June 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Stare the Adventure in Reading will be hosting their second annual Rising Readers Summer Reading Minicamp Series in July. This year, they will have 3 weeks. On week one, from July 6th through 10th, reading and art. On week two, July 13th through 17th, reading and food. On week three, July 20th through 24th, reading and music. All 3 weeks take place between 9 a.m. and 12 p.m. If you would like to be a volunteer camp tutor, you would come in for around an hour near the beginning of each day, from 9 a.m. to 10:15 a.m., and lead one student through a book and literary activities. This mirrors the sessions they've been doing during the school year, except the books will be related to the theme of the specific week. Students are coming each day, so there are many tutor slots to fill. If any tutors are interested in being a camp counselor, please reach out. They would love to have you for a whole week or more. For more information, visit stairnola.org. That is stairnola.org.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.